WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike DeBusky. President Trump now says he's going to impose 30% tariffs on imports from the European Union and Mexico, unless those countries make trade deals with the U.S. by August 1st. But ABC's Olivia Rubin says many countries are waiting to see if that deadline slides.
This date has been pushed back. Right now it sits at August 1st. Previously it sat at July 9th, and previously it sat at Liberation Day in April. So the can keeps getting kicked down the road, and we'll just have to see whether that remains or whether August 1st sticks, and that is, in fact, when these tariffs go into effect.
Memorials are underway this weekend in Texas after last week's catastrophic flash flooding that killed 129 people. One of them was 17-year-old Malaya Grace Hammond. Her father says it happened when their minivan was overrun with floodwater.
I understand the word deluge now in a way that I never wanted to understand it.
Authorities say 160 people are still missing. This is ABC News. The Trump administration is cutting over 1,000 civil service jobs at the State Department, as well as nearly 250 foreign service officers. The administration says it's intended to make the federal workforce more effective, but critics say the move could expose the country to national security threats. Walmart is recalling about 850,000 water bottles over a danger that's made two people blind. ABC's Chuck Sievertson.
Black lids of the silver stainless steel water bottles can blow off, forcefully eject, is how the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission describes it, and can hit users in the face. There are three reports so far with two people suffering permanent vision loss. The recall covers Walmart's Ozark Trail 64-ounce stainless steel insulated water bottles, sold at the chain store since 2017. Regulators say contact Walmart for a full refund, and you can also take the bottles to the store to get your money back.
Two fires are now spreading near the Grand Canyon in Arizona, prompting evacuations. I'm Mike DeBusky, ABC News.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Trump is again trying to have it both ways on agricultural workers. He says they're working on, quote, a temporary pass where the farmer can have a little control as opposed to you walk in and take everybody away. He's describing feudalism, where the people who work the land are more under direct control of the land owners rather than the rule of law. He wants the vassals, he wants the lords, he wants the peasants.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
For 75 years, the Muscular Dystrophy Association's voices have thundered through the halls of Congress.
For 75 years, we've willed the impossible into existence.
For 75 years, the MDA community has pushed the science,
shifted the narrative,
and established the field of neuromuscular medicine.
And until that day when this is all a thing of the past,
you couldn't stop us if you tried.
Join us and celebrate 75 years of breakthroughs at MDA75.org.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Melissa Kay. Who wants to spend their weekday evening learning about the importance of foreign aid? Turns out, more than 24 people at the McMillan Memorial Library in Wisconsin Rapids earlier this week. They were there to hear Greg St. Arnold, an educator based in Milwaukee and former staffer for Senator Russ Feingold. But St. Arnold has also spent years coordinating regional education for the Jesuit Refugee Service in Eastern and Southern Africa. His topic wasn't Congress. It was on the United States' legacy of humanitarianism.
There's three reasons why we should all support foreign aid. Number one is that it makes us safer as Americans.
Recently, a U.S. humanitarian program has officially sunset. USAID has been around since the 1960s, and the Jesuit Refugee Service utilized some of that funding for their aid work. USAID gives aid during conflicts and natural disasters. Think food to Sudanese farmers facing floods and to improve material conditions for people around the world. The thinking is, foreign aid helps prevent future conflicts that would affect us here at home.
Another way that it makes us safer is by stabilizing unstable situations or unstable areas.
But projects to support food security and combat infectious diseases have been gutted by the Trump administration. With most of its staff laid off, USAID formally closed at the start of the month. St. Arnold says that other countries will step in to fill the gap. But he says USAID spending is smart, strategically and morally.
It was the right thing to do for the United States to be engaged in kind of helping build and stabilize these types of places. And we've just kind of walked away from it.
For Civic Media News, I'm Melissa Kay.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Scattered showers and thunderstorms possible today, otherwise partly sunny, highs near 77. For tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-50s. Smoky, hazy, and breezy for Sunday, becoming sunny with a high near 81. Monday, sunshine with a high near 81.
It's 64 at our studios.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we go beyond the cheese with the Canine Convoy based in Oconto. We're talking Dog Bus. Join us.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, the second hour of Amicus here on our weekend review of all things justice-related, rule of law-related, government-related. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this remaining time together here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We spent the first hour talking about Wisconsin-related rule of law issues, in particular this major decision by the Wisconsin Supreme Court reestablishing, if you will, reaffirming the balance of powers between the legislature, specifically a committee, and the governor when it comes to rulemaking has great impacts, not only on the underlying issue there having to do with conversion therapy, but many other areas of our common interest, many things in debate in the legislature, in our state as well. Appreciate very much the comment from Jack bringing to our attention that one of our legislators already condemning that decision by the Wisconsin Supreme Court as a dangerous overreach rather than simply re-affecting and reestablishing the balance of powers. A fascinating review of exactly what the Supreme Court is and is not doing. Appreciate very much that reporting, Tom, and also Dick calling in, underscoring a common theme here as well, that all of these decisions made in the end by human beings, underscoring the importance of voting, because it's through voting that people end up in our legislature and end up in the state house, the governor's house, end up in the White House, in the Congress, and yes, indeed, on the courts, whether elected or appointed. All of that ultimately comes through voting. The importance of Dick's comment, which is not with respect only to attorneys general like William Barr, but all of our elected and appointed people, whoever we send to Madison, to Washington, to our local school boards, to our county boards of directors, boards of commissioners, those kinds of things, whoever we send there, they are human beings. And for that reason, our democracy is dependent upon the quality, the integrity of the people we send there. That may seem very obvious, but it deserves reaffirmation at a time when we are looking a lot at what our nation is all about. We are defined, yes, by the institutions, by the structures that are in place, but from generation to generation, we're defined by the people who occupy those positions, who take those seats. And if we make decisions to put people in those positions who are not reliable, do not have integrity, do not have the competence, the credibility, the mission to support and defend our safety and security, then we are all in trouble. Appreciate very much that observation, Dick, about our former attorney general, but much beyond that as well. Appreciate well, the comments and the inquiries and the observations made by those of you who are texting into our show as well. Mark from Prairie du Sac noting, very much anticipating the subject matter of this, our second hour. He says, I'm not surprised that among the other cabinet appointees, Tom Homan, who is the border czar, has violated his oath to the Constitution and said, in effect, that we don't need probable cause, let alone warrants. We can simply seize persons because of how they look, kind of thing. Mark notes that the founders specifically prohibited in the Constitution opposing what King George was doing. Appreciate that comment, Mark. And making reference again to Tom Homan, maybe not a formal member of the cabinet, but again, the border czar. He's plainly a very significant senior official who has said in the past, although he walked it back a little bit, that federal judges do not have to be followed in their directives, their orders. And now, again, saying it's okay, as Mark has identified, that we can simply arrest people based upon how they look. And indeed, that gets us to our first issue of this hour. And before we do even that, I want to also comment that Matt from Matt Middleton, a slightly different take on all this, the authority of the states and the federal government to act in certain areas. Matt notes, why can't state and local law enforcement block and stand up to federal law enforcement, even a militia? If it is the state's police responsibility to protect its citizens, Matt says, and follow the law, then why do they ignore the law enforcement that are breaking the law? I want to see that controversy resolved in the future. Matt, appreciate all of that. Again, the comments from Mark from Prairie du Sac and from Matt Middleton, both of those lead into our next major rule of law story, breaking just on Friday night of this past week. And again, it goes to those issues of state and local and federal versus federal law enforcement. It is unfortunate even have to be describing it that way. But once again, we see that a federal district court judge engaging in, yes, let's say the word together, an injunction. And again, you may say, well, didn't we prohibit those? The Supreme Court did not prohibit federal district courts from enjoining, from stopping the bad things, the unconstitutional things from happening in our nation. What the Supreme Court said is federal district court judges cannot make their orders nationwide. They cannot have effect presumably beyond the particular district, the particular parties, even that are before a federal district court judge. And that particular rule, again, cutting out of that CASA case, Trump versus CASA, coming out of the Supreme Court of a couple of weeks ago, not violated by what happened in California. A federal judge on Friday, her name is Mame Frimpong. She is in the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California. That's basically Los Angeles, and plainly an awful lot of territory to the north and the south of Los Angeles as well. That's the specific district, the federal district in which Judge Frimpong serves and presides over cases. She says that she is blocking this administration from making indiscriminate immigration arrests in the Los Angeles area and from denying those detainees the right to counsel with their lawyers. Both of those fundamental constitutional rights goes to Mark's point about this notion of protecting people on the streets, protecting our citizens, our residents. You have to have more than just a sense that somebody might be a bad person because of the way they look, may be inclined to do something because of the way they may present. That is not the reasonable suspicion. That's the standard. The reasonable suspicion that law enforcement has to have before detaining, arresting somebody on the street. Two separate restraining orders, again, a form of injunctive relief issued by the judge, again, representing a very strong rebuke of tactics that these federal agents, again, commented on by both Mark and Matt in our chat line. They're a part of our recent history there in Los Angeles, deployed by our president there in and around Los Angeles during these periods of immigration raids and also, of course, the protests, which are also protected under our First Amendment. Again, Judge Frimpong directing agents to stop racial profiling in the course of seeking out immigrants and otherwise doing what may be their legitimate law enforcement function, but you can't do it by racial profiling. And she tells the federal government, as it deploys hundreds of agents from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that's ICE, that's the long spelled out way of describing the ICE agents who are out there. They've got to ensure that detainees have access to legal counsel, a fundamental constitutional right. She enters these two orders, these temporary restraining orders, saying to the government, your federal government can't be engaged in racial profiling when you are engaging in detentions and arrests. We shouldn't have to say that in 2025 in America, but apparently we do. And second, that if you do arrest people, you've got to enable them to have access to counsel. Here's what the judge says in particular. She says, what the federal government would have this court believe in the face of a mountain of evidence presented in this case is that none of this is actually happening. Now, again, a couple of things, takeaways from that comment. What she is reflecting on is the fact that she has had the very evidentiary hearing that we talked about. The reason why we have trial judges, lower court judges, because they can, in fact, take evidence. They do, in fact, hear from witnesses. And in her case, she does, in fact, look at photography and look at videography of what's going on out there. Physical, visual evidence of what's happening there. She says that roving patrols, her words, without reasonable suspicion to arrest people, violated the Fourth Amendment rights of these individuals, and denying access to lawyers violates the Fifth Amendment. Of course, she's right about that in terms of her constitutional references. The ruling basically remains in effect, she says, for 10 days. It comes in response to this lawsuit filed by some immigrant advocacy groups and led by the ACLU of Southern California and others in that area. A fuller hearing. Again, she puts this in place for 10 days. That's the temporary restraining order aspect of this. And she's going to have another hearing. And at that time, there's going to be even more evidence based upon, again, presentations by those people who are attacking what the federal law enforcement is doing with respect to these detentions and arrests, and also giving a chance for the government, the U.S. Department of Justice. That's our adversarial system, to present to her evidence this is not going on. If indeed she is wrong about that, our government has a right to show that that initial conclusion of hers is inaccurate. Los Angeles, of course, one of the largest cities, second largest city in our nation. And it also has about a 30% Latino population, home to the nation's largest population of undocumented people. And so that is why it has been ground zero for much of this litigation activity and law enforcement activity as well. During the hearing that the judge had on Thursday in this matter, she said she was skeptical of the government's assertions that it was not violating the constitutional rights of people and that agents were stopping immigrants and others on the totality of circumstances, which, again, is a legitimate standard for doing so. But you've got to do that, once again, based upon a situation when the totality of those circumstances result in reasonable suspicion. That's the on-the-street standard. Doesn't have to be probable cause. Certainly doesn't have to be clear and convincing, compelling evidence. Certainly not beyond a reasonable doubt. But you have to have some reasonable suspicion that this person is engaging in some kind of activity that's violative of the law. It can't simply be reliance upon how they look, and certainly cannot be based upon race. Now, once again, the government maintaining that it is not doing that will have a fuller opportunity in the formal hearing on the injunctive request as that comes forward. The judge has suspended. Again, she's maintained that this will be in place for 10 days. And at that point, she will review all of this and review once again whether or not her order should stand. Undeniably, this is going to be headed back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's where the district court is located. Maybe again back to the United States Supreme Court, because all of these constitutional issues, these law enforcement issues, these authority of government issues, the executive branch, the authority of a president to intervene in states. We've talked about that in great detail. The 10th Amendment. Setting forth for the states those things that are not expressly set forth in the Constitution. All of those theories wrapped up in this kind of order entered by the judge, Judge Frimpong, just this past week. She described the government's arguments in that case as very general, saying that they did not really engage with the high volume of evidence that the plaintiffs put in the record of these things that we've all seen and heard on the news. That's her preliminary assessment, again, based upon what she's already seen. More of that to come, coming out of the Central District of California. Again, not at all prohibited by the Supreme Court's decision forbidding national injunctions. Why? Because she's not applying it nationally. She's saying in Los Angeles, if there are federal agents who are out there, ICE agents who are making these arrests, absent that reasonable suspicion, that's in violation of the Constitution. Knock it off, she says. Don't do that. And also, if you do detain, if you do arrest people, you've got to afford them a right to counsel. That's fundamental. When we come back, we're also going to talk about another judge, this one on the other side of the country in New Hampshire, entering another injunction. This one a whole lot more broad as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matt Nair on Air.
We want to help you promote your community event for free. Tell us about your nonprofit group or organization's upcoming event, and we'll help you promote it on The Buzz of the North. Email us the information or a copy of the flyer to community@whsm.com. That's community@whsm.com. You can also drop off your flyer at our office on East 3rd Street in Hayward, or mail it to 16880 W, Highway 63, Hayward, 54843. Hometown Radio Refreshed on 96.9 WBZH.
This is the story of the one. As a safety manager at a manufacturing plant, he does everything he can to keep his coworkers safe. From finding ways to reduce risks, to keeping safety supplies in stock. And for that, he relies on Grainger. Grainger offers a broad range of quality products and next-day delivery, so he can always play it safe. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Are you ever questioning when life will slow down? Are you ever thinking of just relaxing and enjoying the simple things? All of this is possible, even while still being in the workforce. Worthington, Minnesota is a town growing, yet it's nothing like metro life. Professional and labor jobs, a beautiful lake, bike trails, recreation, acres of public hunting, festivals, and great people. Slow down. We're just a short drive away, so come join us. Worthington, it's worth a look.
At Hazelden Betty Ford, treating mental health isn't just about breaking old patterns. It's about braving new ones. As the leader in alcohol and drug treatment for 75 years, we know caring for addiction, anxiety, depression, and trauma goes hand in hand. We're here for you with new tools when life breaks down. Discover your path to better mental health at HazeldenBettyFord.org/Wisconsin. Sponsored by Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation.
The Elder Care Locator is here to help you live your best life as you age at home. Our call center advisors are ready to connect you with trustworthy local experts. Help is just a phone call away at 1-800-677-1116.
Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. As always, so appreciating the comments you drop into our studio chat line from good folks like Mark and Matt in the past hour. Also, callers like Dick and Jack who call in with their questions, their inquiries, the times they're scratching their heads or not, simply make an observation about the topics on our syllabus. And those continue now as we talk about yet another federal judge also entering an injunction. We thought we were done with these injunctive stories. We are plainly not in America, nor should we be done with them, because that's what federal district court judges, in the context of executing the duties under their oath of office, that's what they do. They do many other things, of course, in civil areas, criminal areas, adjudicating all kinds of cases, but along the way, civilly, if in fact there are those situations where something has to be stopped as unconstitutional or dangerous or contrary to the safety and security of the community, they can in fact and do have the statutory and even constitutional authority to say stop doing that, and directing the parties before them to do just that, to abide by those rulings. That another issue about the extent to which this government, the administration, this Department of Justice, when told to stop doing something or to do something, that's also another form of injunctive relief,
this administration on a regular basis saying we don't have to follow what federal district court judges do. And that included not only people like Tom Homan, as Mark has identified, but also our attorney general, who has commented about the lack of power in our district court judges to do the very things that our Constitution contemplates. We've got another federal district court judge, this one no less interesting than what the judge in Central California has done with respect to an injunction of federal law enforcement there in Los Angeles. This one, however, coming directly from that recent major decision. Again, probably the most significant decision coming out of the Supreme Court this past term that said no more national injunctions, from the pen of Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett, saying federal national injunctions no more, cannot be universal. You can enjoin people and parties from doing things, but cannot make it effective beyond your district, cannot make it effective beyond the lawsuit, arguably, in which you are resolving some claims. Federal District Court judge, his name is Joseph LaPlante, L-A-P-L-A-N-T. He's in the U.S. District Court for New Hampshire. The New Hampshire District Court there, the state and also the federal court in New Hampshire, blocking the administration from enforcing its very contentious executive order regarding birthright citizenship. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, wait, didn't we resolve this? And the answer, of course, is no. The United States Supreme Court, in that same decision from Amy Coney Barrett and five others in the Supreme Court, did not expressly resolve the issue of whether or not the 14th Amendment contemplates that if you're born here, you get citizenship. As the Supreme Court has said for well over 100 years, as has been our understanding about the interpretation of the 14th Amendment for that entire period of time, all of that now back in the news after the Supreme Court's decision. This particular judge, his name is Joseph LaPlante, U.S. District of New Hampshire. He stops the order, and he does it in this very interesting and legally focused way. He recalls as well, he notes that in Amy Coney Barrett's major opus on establishing this new prohibition on federal courts, that while they can't enter national injunctions, they can entertain and identify and certify what are called class actions. That is, a group of people, could be a smaller group, could be thousands, could be hundreds of thousands of people, could be millions of people, arguably, who suffer the same kind of consequences called commonality. If they've got commonality in the things that they have suffered, their underlying claims are the same or roughly the same. If the legal premises for their challenges against what's going wrong or the reasons why they're bringing their lawsuit, if those are similar, it's called commonality. The judge can then do what's called certify the class, and then move on to the underlying claims against them, basically saying, here is the group of plaintiffs. Here are all the people who are going to be able to challenge whatever the defendants in a particular case are saying. So what does this judge do using that very language of the Supreme Court that specifically, expressly enabled parties to pursue still class actions? What he does is he certifies a lawsuit as a class action. It's brought by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of some clients there in New Hampshire. And he basically says, I am certifying a class of all of the babies who've been born basically since February, which was when the executive order took effect. All the babies who've been aggrieved, been compromised, if you will, whose citizenship as a result of this executive order have been called into question. That is the class I am certifying. It happens to be a class certification nationwide, he says. But because of that, that commonality prompts him to certify the class. The children of undocumented parents and those born to academics in the United States on student visas, that is the two categories that fall under the administration's executive order, those born on or after February 20th of this year. So we're talking about babies, right? Babies who are weeks, in a few cases, months old or so. That's the class. Children of undocumented parents, people who are illegally here, and those born to people who are here on student visas. And he has certified the class and said, as to all of you in that class nationwide, I am enjoining the enforcement of that executive order. The lawsuit, again, brought by the ACLU, filed among many other lawsuits within hours after the Supreme Court's decision of a couple of weeks ago that limited the capacity of federal judges, yes, including Judge LaPlante, to issue nationwide injunctions. And this case appears to test the limits of that approval for class actions in that very same Supreme Court decision, and plainly will be the subject of more review. The judge, again, entering this order just this past week and basically protecting all of the people in this particular category. They are infants. They are babies born since this executive order took place. When we come back, I'll tell you more about the impact of that, why it's important, and then we'll also talk about something else the Supreme Court did just this past week here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
ABC News, I'm Mike DeBusky. President Trump now says he's going to impose 30% tariffs on imports from the European Union and Mexico, unless those countries make trade deals with the U.S. by August 1st. But ABC's Olivia Rubin says many countries are waiting to see if that deadline slides.
This date has been pushed back. Right now it sits at August 1st. Previously it sat at July 9th, and previously it sat at Liberation Day in April. So the can keeps getting kicked down the road, and we'll just have to see whether that remains or whether August 1st sticks, and that is, in fact, when these tariffs go into effect.
Memorials are underway this weekend in Texas after last week's catastrophic flash flooding that killed 129 people. One of them was 17-year-old Malaya Grace Hammond. Her father says it happened when their minivan was overrun with floodwater.
I understand the word deluge now in a way that I never wanted to understand it.
Authorities say 160 people are still missing. This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers host the Nationals. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers face the Nationals in game two of their three-game series. Brandon Woodruff gets the start. Last night, the Brewers won the opener 8-3. At his press conference after the game, manager Pat Murphy had this to say.
Good. Hey, I got another announcement, guys, before you get up. Jacob Mizorowski will pitch in the All-Star game.
Mizorowski says Murphy told him the news about 5 minutes before the start of the National Anthem.
Got called in the Murph's office and sitting in there, and he's like, hey, close the door, come on. Get in here, and yeah, basically broke it to me, and I had to sit there the whole game and not tell anyone.
Mizorowski joins Trevor McGill, representing the team at the All-Star game Tuesday night, teammate Quinn Priester.
That's awesome. No, I was fired up. I was really fired up for him. It is, it's electric to watch. I'm excited for those guys who get to see it from a dugout view like I've been able to, and he's going to represent us really well.
That's Brewers pitcher Quinn Priester with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Scattered showers and thunderstorms possible today, otherwise partly sunny, highs near 77. For tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-50s. Smoky, hazy, and breezy for Sunday, becoming sunny with a high near 81. Monday, sunshine with a high near 81.
It's 64 at our studios.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
I get why you, Senator Royce, were a no vote on this budget. I think the people that voted no on this were standing up for public education.
I think that's exactly right. We heard from people loud and clear in this budget cycle and 2 years ago, the number one priority that people asked for, whether they called, emailed, or showed up at the public hearings, they want our schools funded. Our kids deserve better schools. They have been underfunded for decades, and it is time for us to prioritize public education.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station, and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
Stephanie Bloomingdale, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. The Big Beautiful Bill is basically an all-out assault on working Americans.
No tax on tips. It's not as good as it sounds because a lot of tipped workers are not paying that higher level of taxes in the first place.
As the wealthiest among us dine at the feast of all feasts, don't be fooled by the table scraps.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m.
In sitcoms, when someone has a problem, they just blurt it out and move on.
Well, I lost my job and my parakeet is missing. How was your day?
But the real world is different. Managing life's challenges can be overwhelming. So, what do? We get support. The Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council have mental health resources available for you at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. See how much further you can go when you take care of your mental health.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Being blind doesn't look how others may think.
Retinitis pigmentosa aimed to overwhelm my family.
It tried to cut me down.
I know where to find support.
Learn more at fightingblindness.org. A public service message from the Foundation Fighting Blindness.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll be back from the Northern Wisconsin State Fair and the world headquarters of Madison, taking a look at the weekend headlines and looking ahead to our next road trip with Jane, Matt, and Air. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, talking once again about this recurring feature on our broadcast called injunction function, the function of federal district court judges, among their many other responsibilities, to enjoin bad things from happening, whether those are in violation of statutes, violations of laws of various kinds. And indeed, that continues. This past week, we've got a federal district court judge in Central California basically telling law enforcement, federal law enforcement, they cannot arrest people on the streets based upon how they look, cannot do racial profiling, have to have a reasonable suspicion for doing that. That's the law. It is unfortunate that we have to have federal judges taking their time and their attention reaffirming what the law is in America, but apparently we need to do that, at least for our federal law enforcement, at least some component of it. And then we've got this federal district court judge. His name is Joseph LaPlante. He is in New Hampshire, who has taken up the invitation of the United States Supreme Court in that case called Trump versus CASA, C-A-S-A, and has said, I'm going to certify a class. And I'm going to certify a class of all those children of undocumented parents, that is, people who have been here illegally, and the children of those born to people here on student visas, academics, in the United States on or after February 20th, which was the effective date of President Trump's executive order, affirming from the White House that those groups of people are not citizens. The judge this past week saying, no, they are, and identifying them by virtue of the commonality of their class, wherever they may be beyond New Hampshire, and finding that the executive order cannot be implemented as to them. Undeniably, this will be appealed. Certainly already, probably the pleadings on their way to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. Maybe there will be again another one of these emergency petitions to the United States Supreme Court, which I now bemoan on a regular basis because of, again, leapfrogging over the proper and usual course of events when there is no urgent need to do so. This case will certainly not go away anytime soon. Maybe coming back to the Supreme Court for further interpretation of whether a class action can provide the predicate for a national injunction of the sort that Judge LaPlante has entered just this past week. It is fascinating as a legal matter. It is critically important as a law enforcement matter, yes, indeed, as a jurisprudential issue. Most importantly, the top of the list, important to the people of this country, constitutional right to citizenship when you are born here, period. That's the way it's been interpreted. That is what the Supreme Court could and should have done instead of creating the administrative complexity that they now have. Tom Homan, referenced by Mark earlier, who is the border czar for this White House, in response to what Judge LaPlante has done, mimicking what he has said in the past about the lack of authority of federal judges to do their job, declined to say exactly how the administration respond, but following, again, this Well known, this pattern of his, he lit into the judge. He said, it's another example of radical judges not paying attention to the Supreme Court ruling. These radical judges aren't going to stop, he said. They want to stop the Trump agenda, and what they need to understand is the American people voted for this agenda. A lot to unpack there, and I will let you do that in determining whether Tom Homan is right. I would offer he is completely wrong about the authority of federal district court judges. He has the absolute right to articulate that view. What he doesn't have the right to do is to take the next step and advocate for any sort, incite any kind of violence, threats against judges. And that, of course, is what we have seen with increasing frequency in recent times. The entire threat issue whenever judges and other officials of the federal and state and even local government engage in conduct with which one or more persons may have some objection, not appropriate, never appropriate, in violation of the criminal law to threaten and certainly to act on those threats. And we have had prosecutions of those people. The statements themselves in opposition to what judges do, yes, that is permissible under the First Amendment. It is not permissible to go to the next step. We will see how this plays out from the District of New Hampshire, coming from the desk of Joseph LaPlante, and seeing what the administration and others around the country do now that we arguably have another injunction based upon a class status of these young people, basically newborns. The executive order, according to the Supreme Court, on June 27th stayed for 30 days. So we've got until July 27th for these lawsuits and other things to play out in America, including in New Hampshire, including other places, arguably including Wisconsin as well. And additionally, we've got yet more federal action. Let's talk about our Supreme Court in particular, all these cases deriving from recent Supreme Court decisions. Let's get back to what the Supreme Court itself did just this past week on Tuesday. You might think, gee, once again, aren't we done with these decisions coming out of the Supreme Court, the 67 or so that they've issued since the early October of last year? And the answer is yes. On those big cases that have gotten the proper review, there have been appeals, there have been oral arguments, there have been memorandums of law, briefs written by lawyers, presented to the government, presented to the defense in exchange of differing views, and then presented, of course, to the Supreme Court itself for its review. All of that is the process that we contemplate at the federal level and, yes, at the state level as well. We don't, as I've been advocating during the course of this broadcast, don't need to go right away to the highest court in the land if, in fact, the matter is not truly an emergency. And that is the case most often when the status quo does not need to be changed while we're litigating the underlying events. Emergency applications when the house is on fire, when the flood is happening, of the sort we're seeing horrifically right now in Texas. That kind of thing where you need to have a court jump in immediately to preserve life. An emergency application, even in the context of death penalty litigation, where you want a court to take one last look to determine if there's been any mistake at lower court levels before you pursue the death penalty in a particular state. All those kinds of things, urgent, immediate, life-compromising, potentially, if in fact the courts do not act. Question whether or not all of these emergency applications are falling into that category. Here's another one that comes from yet another of the president's executive orders. This comes again fairly early in the president's current term. He announced early on in his term that he would like all of the major agencies, frankly, all the federal agencies, 19 of them, 11 of them cabinet-level offices and cabinet-level agencies, begin, he said, all of them, directing all the officials in those agencies to assemble plans and protocols for large-scale cuts to the federal workforce, slash many, many of members of the federal workforce, and directs them all to undertake those initiatives. And now I know you're saying, well, gee, isn't that the Musk team doing all that? And yes, indeed, plainly, that was the authority in part given to them to do all these firings in all of these different areas, including shutting down institutions like USAID and, yes, going after the Department of Education, many others out there. And as a result of this executive order, again, a challenge to it brought again in federal courts. And just this past week, this particular executive order lands in front of the Supreme Court once again on an emergency application. How does this come to the Supreme Court? Why is this an emergency application to stop these large-scale cuts from happening? Well, on May 9th, there's another federal district court judge. Her name is Susan Ilston. She's in Northern California, another district in California. She pauses the administration's, Donald Trump's, plans for these massive layoffs and program closures and the things that will send federal workforce out into the streets. She prevents about two dozen agencies from moving forward with the president's directed plans to shrink the federal workforce. Judge Ilston initially issued a two-week pause. Later that month, she extended that, and eventually it comes to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That is the appellate court. That's how the process works once again. And the appellate court, by a divided three-judge panel, supports what Judge Ilston has done on May 30th. The Trump administration then files an emergency application. Rather than having this reviewed in the due course, emergency application asking for immediate capacity of the administration to follow up on this executive order to lay off tens of thousands of employees at agencies like Housing and Urban Development and State Department and Treasury. And what happens just this past week? Again, the Trump administration gets what it wants in front of the Supreme Court. Typical of these emergency applications, what happens? You get no explanation, no description, as you do in those 67 other cases of this past term and of other 60 numbered cases of previous terms, sometimes even 70 cases. You don't get the explanation, the large 30 and 40 and 50 page orders explaining why it is they're doing what they're doing. Instead, you get a one-line order. And we got that again this past week when the Supreme Court, interestingly, an 8-1 majority of the Supreme Court saying that the president can, in fact, go ahead, overturning what the Ninth Circuit and what Judge Ilston had done and saying, go ahead, administration, begin to pursue your plans. They already have, plainly, to fire great numbers of people. Typical, again, of an emergency application. No explanation, no exposition, but do it right away. And they're finding plainly that this is an emergency. And for that reason, the president given permission just this past week to go ahead with all of these firings. Interestingly, there is one dissenting voice, only one this time. We don't hear from Sonia Sotomayor or Elena Kagan. We hear from Ketanji Brown Jackson. She wrote a public dissent, 15 pages, and she is sharply criticizing the court's decision. She calls it not only truly unfortunate, but also hubristic, invoking the notion of hubris and senseless, she says. She argues that it undercuts the authority of trial court judges, which is also what she said in connection with that CASA case. She said, you know, we've got to be able to, as federal judges, tell other branches of government when they're engaging in violations of the Constitution. She goes on to say it is not this court's role to swoop in and second guess a lower court's factual findings. She said that no one seriously disputes the president's executive order would lead to enormous real-world consequences, including, she says, the dismantling of much of the government as Congress has created it, going back to this notion that it's Congress who can restyle federal agencies. The majority plainly does not agree with her. Here's what she says in conclusion. She says what one person or one president might call bureaucratic bloat, B-L-O-A-T, is a farmer's prospect for a healthy crop, a coal miner's chance to breathe free from black lung, or a preschool's opportunity to learn in a safe environment. That's Ketanji Brown Jackson in opposition to what the Supreme Court has done, permitting this administration to go ahead with his executive order and fire, show the door to literally tens of thousands of workers by virtue of the executive order entered by this president. We know, in effect, that that has its direct effect. We have seen that just late this past week at the United States Department of State. We know that our Secretary of State has already announced previously his decisions to downsize the State Department talking about the bloat in the agency for which he is now responsible. And we know that as a result of that, the Trump administration, not just by virtue of what the Supreme Court now is permitted to do, but these plans were already underway, downsizing the federal government, firing more than 1,000 State Department employees on Friday of this past week alone. You saw these pictures of people carrying boxes outside of the State Department on C Street, just a few blocks from, frankly, the White House and the Justice Department. And that's underway now. When we come back, we'll tell you more about the impact of that State Department action to fire all these individuals and then do some rule of law snapshots. What's
join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
We want to help you promote your community event for free. Tell us about your nonprofit group or organization's upcoming event, and we'll help you promote it on the Buzz of the North. Email us the information or a copy of the flyer to community at whsm.com. That's community at whsm.com. You can also drop off your flyer at our office on East 3rd Street in Hayward, or mail it to 16880 W, Highway 63, Hayward, 54843. Hometown Radio Refreshed on 96.9 WBZH.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. In a chaotic and somewhat discombobulating end to the process, Wisconsin lawmakers passed a state budget and Governor Tony Evers signed it into law at about 1:30 a.m. on July 3rd. What made this budget different from the others signed in this era of divided government is that Democratic votes were needed to pass the budget in the state Senate. Part of the reason that was made possible is because of new, fairer maps. Last November, Senate Democrats flipped four seats, shrinking the Republican majority to just an 18-15 margin. Now, candidates are already lining up to take this the rest of the way and flip the chamber. Democrat Jenna Jacobson, who currently serves in the Assembly, is now running for Senate, challenging Republican Howard Markline in the 17th District. If Democrats can flip that district and one more seat, they could control the state Senate for the first time in more than 15 years. That would be a big deal for state politics in Wisconsin.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
You want to feel important.
You want to be part of something bigger, something that matters and can help change things.
You want to feel like you belong.
We know. We felt that way too. And that's why we did something about it.
We aren't just Army National Guard soldiers.
We are normal people just like you. But our part-time service in the Army National Guard means we get to be more.
When our communities are in need, we get the chance to stand up and do something about it.
We get to serve in our own region and help the people we call neighbors.
From the lake shores of Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota.
The fertile fields of Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa to the wide open plains of North and South Dakota.
We are here for our hometowns.
And together, we can make a difference. Take on your legacy. Visit NationalGuard.com to find out more.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Trump is again trying to have it both ways on agricultural workers. He says they're working on, quote, a temporary pass where the farmer can have a little control as opposed to you walk in and take everybody away. He's describing feudalism, where the people who work the land are more under direct control of the land owners rather than the rule of law. He wants the vassals. He wants the lords. He wants the peasants.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, the Law Review, already our final segment of this weekend show, talking about what the Supreme Court did just this past week, permitting the president, the administration, and all the agencies over which the White House has responsibility to go ahead with workforce slashings, that is, reductions in force across the board, arguably 19 different agencies, 11 of them cabinet level. And we've seen that already. Probably underway at the State Department and many other agencies. Just this past Friday, about 1,000 people told that they should not come back on Monday. 1,400 layoffs announced on Friday, 1,000 of them already accomplished. The number apparently at the Department of State probably approaching about 3,000 altogether. our Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, announcing that this is a part of his ongoing plan to make the State Department more sleek and more effective and more efficient in terms of its overall operation and making a change dramatically in our America's global engagement. We will see how this impacts our role in the world stage generally. I can say that from the 2 years that I spent, again, many years ago during the latest Iraq War, 2006 to 2008, when I was at the U.S. Embassy and other places in Iraq, but in Baghdad, had an up-close and very, very direct engagement with State Department people. Largest embassy at that time, physically located in Saddam's old palace. Largest embassy in on the face of the planet because, plainly, of our focus upon trying to establish some peace, some security in the wake of the war that undeniably, we had sparked by virtue of the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. The purpose of the State Department, and yes, of me and others at the Justice Department there, to try to establish a republic in the wake of that war, in the midst of that war in 2006 and 2008, not at all an easy prospect. But today, of course, regardless of what one may think about the genesis of that war, and it was indeed premised upon some not just faulty, but inaccurate and outright false information about Saddam's capacity to have weapons of mass destruction. Today, there is a republic in Iraq at great cost. Tens of thousands of people, not just Iraqis, plainly at the top of the list, but also coalition forces gave their lives, many injured. There is a republic there today, and there is a prime minister and a president, and there is a notion of voting and republic notions. Democracy is afoot there. It is imperfect as it is in our nation. And I tell you all that because that is in large measure not so much of me and as the head of the rule of law initiative there, the justice attaché, although we had a small group there working throughout the country to those same ends to establish courts and prisons and police in ways that are consistent with basic principles of human rights and civil rights, but also those State Department people, the ambassadors for whom I worked, Khalilzad and Crocker and others there, responsible in way too few numbers for ensuring that things like the development of the country happen economically, socially, politically, commercially, culturally, putting together that parliament, ensuring that there is advocacy and assistance to the emerging Iraqi republic. All of that by virtue of State Department officials, State Department employees overseas in the middle of that war and certainly beyond. We are still there, again, still the largest embassy on the face of the planet, right there on the border of the Tigris River. All of that being effectuated, being accomplished by civil servants, not political appointees, civil servants who are there to ensure that America's place on the planet is secure, but most importantly, that the world order is promoted and secured in places like Iraq and in virtually every other place where we have diplomatic relations, including those places where there is tumult. That's what the State Department does. That's what you lose when you begin to show thousands of people the door, whether the State Department is there in Washington, D.C. on C Street, whether these employees are around the country at embassies and at missions at various countries around the planet. You compromise the capacity, as many former ambassadors are now saying, in the capacity of the government of the United States to be a player in world peace and world order. And you also open the door when you minimize our presence there to others, including China and other places, other countries around the world who will take up the absence of us and have an influence that is not in our best national interests. That's the compromise when you begin to minimize, yes, the federal workforce generally, but also right there at the State Department. Down the street, down Pennsylvania Avenue, Constitution and Independence, you've got the Department of Justice, not too far away from the State Department. It's on 9th and Pennsylvania. And there, again, Pam Bondi also engaging in her workforce reduction, firing just this past week more of the prosecutors who were responsible for investigating and then prosecuting those hundreds of people who attempted to overthrow our government on January 6th. This past week, At least three federal prosecutors are fired. They are shown the door. They were given dismissal slips, and they were given those by Attorney General Pam Bondi and Deputy Attorney General of the United States. His name is Todd Blanche. They notified the recipients that they were removed from federal service effective immediately. No reason for the removal was stated in the letters. One of those fired employees, now based overseas, told, come back home. You no longer have a job. At least three of them now at the Department of Justice. You know well that previously there have been other employees also involved in those prosecutions in the U.S. Attorney's Office at Maine Justice who were previously fired. How are they different? Those were probationary attorneys. These now are attorneys who are there long tenured. These are people who had the experience and the background that we value in prosecution, whether it's for January 6th or other kinds of cases. We also know as well that there is great tumult generally inside the Department of Justice. We're still trying to figure out what's going on with respect to the Attorney General and Todd Blanche and the FBI. And Don Bongiorno, who is the deputy director of the FBI, Kash Patel, the director of the FBI, rumors about their departures, all of that arguably going to be resolved in the near future. Not a good situation right now at the U.S. Department of Justice. We'll talk more about that and justice generally and the rule of law generally and government generally next weekend. Once again, join us next weekend here on Amicus, a law review. Have a good weekend, everybody.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike DeBusky. President Trump is threatening to levy new tariffs on some of America's closest trading partners. The European Union and Mexico will face 30% tariffs starting on August 1st, according to a new social media post from the president, up from 25%. That's if those partners are unable to strike a new trade deal with the U.S. by that deadline. Yesterday, the president and the first lady toured the part of Central Texas that was ravaged by flash flooding last week, and this weekend, memorials to those who lost their lives.
Overnight, a vigil held to remember the 129 victims from the deadly flash flooding that ripped through Texas hill country a week ago.
Lost a lot, but I know that I have hope. You know, if that's the one message that you walk away with, and that's hope.
ABC's Jacqueline Lee, at least 160 people are still missing. This is ABC News.